Hey, welcome to the podcast. We have a fascinating podcast. Today, in the middle of the podcast, the Mueller press conference happened. And so we tried to figure this out and really tried to look at it as if this was Harry Truman. You know, somebody that, you know, or Eisenhower, somebody that you're not really passionate for or against per se. And it's away, far enough away from our emotions, because it's hard to look at this and not see what the press is doing, not see what the Democrats are trying to do. And so your defenses go up. So we have to look at it clinically. And I know what the media is saying about this. What was our impression when Mueller finally spoke out? I think it may surprise you that also Missouri's abortion rules and Netflix saying, hey, you kill babies and we're going to come to your state with money. I mean, it's insane. Plus a really great couple, Chris and Emily Norton, who you might have seen their viral video. He's paralyzed in a wheelchair, and he was in college and he was graduating. He just wanted to make it across to accept his diploma walking. He did. That video went viral, but you don't know the half of their story. It's amazing. All that and so much coming up in today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Imagine being evicted from your home for not paying your home equity loan back, but you never took out a home equity loan. That would suck, wouldn't it? I mean, literally evicted from your home. We've been telling you about this couple in Portland, Bill and Betty. They had no idea that somebody had taken their house and forged the title, gone over to a bank, taken all of the, you know, equity loans out that they possibly could. Bill and Betty start getting these things. They discard them. We didn't take out that loan. The bank insists that, yes, you did take out that loan. They're like, no, it's not us. Next thing they know, the house is foreclosed on, and they've had to spend thousands of dollars to get their house back. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. We can get a free title scan to you right now to make sure that your house is still your house and this hasn't happened to you. Fastest growing crime, according to the FBI, and only one company is standing guard on it. HomeTitleLock.com. HomeTitleLock.com. Register your home now. Make sure your title has not already been tampered with. $100 value for free. HomeTitleLock.com. Go there now. HomeTitleLock.com. So where do you want to start, Stu, as we're standing on the summit? About to reach the peak of Everest, and it's crowded as we're looking at all of the stories.
They need like a Wendy's or something up there.
Can I tell you something? It's grotesque what it's turned into.
I mean, it's a lot of people want to do it, right? I mean, a lot of people want to say they scaled Everest, and at some point, so many people have scaled Everest, no one wants to say they scaled Everest anymore.
Do you want to scale Everest and stand in line for your photo op? It's like Disney.
It is.
It's grotesque.
Well, it's really just a, you know, this is a dumb complication, but basically there's only like a very short time you can actually do it.
Right.
And so they give away, I mean, look, it's Nepal.
I know.
They're like, here, we have one thing. That giant hill over there.
I know.
Charge whatever we can.
Yeah, they're charging $11,000 for the permit to do it, and everybody's paying it.
Yeah.
And so they're like, okay.
And this time it was a relatively short period, even shorter than normal, so everyone rushed up there at the same time.
And you know that they're like, people are passing dead bodies?
Yeah.
Because you can't get dead bodies down. It's like $70,000 to remove a body from the top of Mount Everest, and people have died. And so they just leave them there. So you're like, hey, I'm going to get my photo op. That's a dead body over there.
Yeah.
Well, just keep it out of the, crop it out of the picture. I mean, it's weird what's happening.
It is. It is. So I don't know that I would start with the Everest thing.
No.
Myself, but
yeah, no.
I think the Missouri thing is significant. Basically, there is a new moment in this abortion conversation that we're having right now.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri has implemented some of the most restrictive abortion laws in America. And, you know, obviously this is all going to an eventual Supreme Court challenge of many different parts of Roe versus Wade, but also the entirety of it. But Missouri has one abortion clinic left, and it is Planned Parenthood. And they have been audited at Planned Parenthood. And so Planned Parenthood is they actually did have problems. They went through the entire audit and they found significant issues. Planned Parenthood gave them a plan, and this is how we're going to correct those issues. And the state's like, yeah, well, that doesn't look sufficient. We want to have some interviews with some of the people who work there. And Planned Parenthood is refusing. Think about this. If you are an abortion supporter for a second, you are saying this is this fundamental right and it's all about women's rights. And then Planned Parenthood is saying, yeah, we're not going to let you interview our doctors to keep this clinic open. They're saying, no, you can't interview them. Now, God only knows what would happen if they did interview them, because who knows what shady stuff they've been doing there and what they would admit to under questioning. They may. And that is probably why Planned Parenthood doesn't want them interviewed. But if they don't interview them, the state is saying, well, if you don't go along with the process that we've outlined here, you are going to your license is going to expire and we're not going to renew it. So that expires, I believe, in 1 week.
Can you imagine any other business? You imagine financial sector, car sector, anybody, when the state licenses you and you as a business say, no, you can't interview us on the license renewal. No, you can't talk to any of us. How dare you even think about talking to us? Everybody would say, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? What are you hiding? And maybe they're not hiding anything. Maybe it's just on principle. But if you're a regulated industry, you imagine the cable company saying to Congress, you know what? We're not showing up.
You have to understand, though, Glenn, there's a fundamental principle of the left that they just don't believe in government regulation.
Really?
They don't want the government in the business of a doctor and patient relationship.
Well,
they want nothing to do with that.
Except for universal health care.
Well, yeah, and every other interaction, including
right.
things that you buy over the counter. They want
right.
And they want the FDA to basically block every new medication until
exactly
the end of time.
Right. Exactly
and they
right.
want to be able to sue every drug manufacturer every time someone has a negative side effect. And sure, they want to do all of those things. And they want to be involved in every aspect of your life from birth to death. But this one thing, they are just basically Ayn Rand on.
Right.
They don't want any government interaction.
Imagine the left if the insurance industry or the drug manufacturing industry said, we're not taking any questions. You can't question us. How dare you even question us? Yeah. Can you imagine what they'd be saying?
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
No, but they have special rights. Planned Parenthood gets special rights because they're a protected political group. And their case is basically they're harassing us. They're coming up with these things, these crazy things that we have to do, and we're not going to go along with them anymore. But again, if you're protecting a fundamental human right, like you say you are, surely interviews is not too far, right? That's not too much to ask. They're doing this because I think they think there could be a potential disaster if they get their employees in front of these people questioning who might think a little bit more about themselves and say, look, I'm going to be honest. I don't want to get thrown in jail for lying about any of this. So they may be honest. And that is not what Planned Parenthood wants. It'll be interesting. This would be the first state since Roe versus Wade occurred to have zero abortion clinics in it. They would have zero as of next week.
I have to tell you, this by the Democrats forcing this by taking such an extreme position, they are forcing people that have never thought about it before, never wanted to think about it because it was in that safe, legal and rare category. And people were happy living there. The vast majority, I shouldn't say vast, 50-60% of Americans were happy living there. Safe, rare, legal. It just covered everything for most people in America. And because they got away from safe, rare, and legal to shout your abortion. Abortions are great. My best abortion happened, the first abortion, to where it's crazy. Yeah. It forced people to go, wait a minute. That's life. Oh, now, wait a minute. When does life actually start? And we're having real deep conversations for the very first time. And it may not be happening on the left, but it is happening on the right. And that's why you're seeing states like Missouri say, none, zero. Because people are having this. They have played this card because they believe that there is enough Americans who will say, oh my gosh, look, they're trying to shut down all abortions. I'm going to vote for the people who said, yeah, you can let the child die after birth. I'm going to vote for them because of these extremists that don't want anything because they say it's life. I'm sorry. I don't think you're going to win. I really don't. I think Americans are fair. They don't want to be involved in your life. They don't. They won't want to be involved in your decisions. They have enough hard decisions to make on their own. I don't know about you, but I'm dealing with my teenage kids, and I don't need to mess with you. Why am I getting involved in your life? My life is enough. I'd like somebody to help me out on mine. I'm looking for some answers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's where most people are. But when you go so far where you're like, yeah, that's not even a kid. What?
Right. I mean, abortion's biggest friend has always been the ability to drown out the thought about it.
Yes.
Right. And so, like, you think about it.
Because people,
like,
don't want to think about
it. Right. Like, you're in an apartment, right? And you hear yelling and fighting in the next apartment through the walls. Uh-huh. Abortion's biggest friend has been America's unending ability to just turn up the music really loud and not hear it, right? And so that's going on, you know, so what?
Because of our tolerance, because we don't want to get involved in somebody else's affairs.
Right, and so that's your starting point, right? Uh-huh. However, when you hear the plate hit the wall and break, and you hear a giant piece of furniture turn over, and at that point, Americans, all right, I got to turn the music down and listen to this because what the hell is going on? I got to call the cops.
Yep.
And that is where we are, I think, with abortion.
I think so, too.
They have come to the point where you can't ignore it anymore because of the extremes they're going to. And that overall is a good thing. I fear the idea that we're in a debate about the ninth month of pregnancy because, you know,
because if you lose this,
the Overton window moves.
Yeah, you lose this debate. If people go numb on this, we are then killing children. We are the next thing we debate is, you know, their health care is too expensive, so just let them die. I mean, that's what's going to happen because historically, that's what happens. And I think America is drawing the line. I thought about this a lot last night. And I listened to three different speeches. I listened to George Washington's farewell address, Eisenhower's farewell
address.
You got
audio of Washington's? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's actually audio. Somebody else read it, but yes.
I did figure that.
So Washington's farewell address, Eisenhower's farewell address, and Reagan's time for choosing. And I want to work on this a bit for tomorrow's broadcast, but I will tell you that everything that they said is happening now, and everything that they were talking about is 100% reasonable, I believe, to our Democratic neighbors. To those who vote Democrat, they will listen to these words if they are presented in the right way. They will listen to those words and go, yeah, that's true. I agree with that. Absolutely. Mm. And I remember in 2008, you might remember this, we were so freaked out and I prayed so hard and I got two answers. One, these are not enemies of yours. They're enemies of mine. Anybody who stands against freedom, basic human freedom, they're not enemies of yours. Those are my rights. I've lent it. You're going to have to fight for them. But those are my rights that I lend to you. So be on my side. I'm not on your side. I'm on the side of rights. Be on my side. That was the first thing. At the same time, I got another message, and that was their arrogance will be their undoing. Don't worry. Their arrogance will be their undoing. And that's what we're seeing right now. They are so arrogant. They so believe that they are in the majority because of the media and everything else that they're not afraid to say anything. And they're saying the craziest damn stuff, and Americans are waking up.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. I want to introduce you to an amazing, amazing couple. They have just been named the hottest event keynote speakers of 2018. And that includes, you know, the likes of Mark Cuban and Barbara Cochran and Magic Johnson and everybody else you can think of. They are motivational speakers, I guess, but really the motivation, I think, just comes from the way they live their life. Chris Norton, Emily Norton, author of The Seven Longest Yards. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So anybody who doesn't know you, tell me what The Seven Longest Yards are.
Yeah, so The Seven Longest Yards, it came from this goal that I set that I'm going to walk Emily 7 yards down the aisle of our wedding side by side, which, you know, listening, you probably think that should be easy. Mm-hmm. Well, in 2010, as a 18-year-old kid, I was playing college football, and I was running down to make the tackle, and I see the opening, just a routine tackle, but I mistimed my jump just by a split second. And so instead of getting my head in front of the ball carrier, my head collides right with his legs. And instantly, I lose all feeling and movement from my neck down. And I was given a 3% chance to ever regain any feeling or movement back below the neck after suffering a severe spinal cord injury, which I, at the time, I felt like my life was over. And eventually, it led to meeting Emily and then setting this goal that we're going to walk down the aisle for a wedding. And actually, the walk down the aisle ended up being the easiest part of our journey.
And your journey, you guys met 3 years after,
we did.
Right? And you went through some dark times mm-hmm. as well. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So after college, I went through a dark time of depression and suffering with anxiety. And I've always had just a big passion and a heart for helping kids who have been abused, neglected, without families, just had this big passion for kids in foster care and struggling with those things. So I always took that on my own shoulders and had this responsibility that it was my responsibility to help these kids. And instead of letting it out, I kept mm-hmm. it in. And it really wore on me. I started not caring as much, stopped feeling, and just started losing me. Honestly, I thought I would never be me again. Like, I thought I was gone. Emily was gone forever. No hope. And I suffered for way longer than I should have because I was very against getting help. I felt like I had to do it myself.
Yeah.
Very independent. Felt like if I got help, that was weakness and that.
It's crazy.
It is.
When
yeah.
you change that one viewpoint, mm-hmm. that it is a strength to ask
yes.
for help, not
yes.
weakness, everything changes in
100%.
Your life.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was. Being able to just come to that realization that you have to ask for help, you have to depend on God. There's nothing wrong with that. And it does. It takes more strength to ask for help and admit mm-hmm. like something's going on and it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But another thing that was holding me back from help was I didn't think that I could be depressed. Why would I be depressed? Mm-hmm. Never gone through anything difficult, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't understand it at all. I understood that other people who went through hard things could get depressed. But for me, like I had this, there's no way, that doesn't make sense. So I just kept pushing through it and don't like being vulnerable. And so I shoved it all inside, all of the things that just create a disaster and so much more struggles than I should have been. And it lasted for a few years because of those views that I was holding
on to. And where were you in that recovery when you two met online?
Yeah. So, I mean, so that was before any of this started. I was at a really good place when we met online, and it was actually right after the graduation walk that it really hit me. I had some signs before, but we stayed so busy with working hard and focusing on the graduation walk. But after the graduation walk and after it went viral, when everything was going so great, I went down and I hit the bottom with where I was at.
Tell me about the graduation walk.
Yeah. So this was the first big goal of mine after my injury. I set the goal, I want to walk across the stage in my college graduation. Didn't know how I was going to do it, but I was going to work as hard as I possibly could each and every day. And I told Emily about this goal when we first met, and she was just as excited as this goal as I was. And she became my personal trainer, my best personal trainer that I've ever had. And we just worked relentlessly for this walk across the stage, which I thought in my mind, I got to walk as fast as I can so I don't get booed off the stage and people are like, checking the clock, like it's hot in the gym. Like graduations are long. And
right.
I'm like, oh man, I gotta book it across there. And so when we start going across the stage, this a roar of just cheering and clapping. And then I finally get across and I look out and the whole room, they're just, everyone's crying.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't believe the reaction, the response. And then eventually that video goes viral and it just takes.
People are still crying every time they see it.
Yeah.
I'm about crying with just hearing you saying
yeah.
Now, so you guys didn't just get through your own little struggles. You have taken 17. How old are you?
26.
27. You have had 17 foster kids and adopted five?
Yes, we have.
The five hell girls. Is wrong with you?
Yeah, five girls.
You really haven't recovered from hitting that guy's leg.
No, I haven't. Yeah.
Right.
Maybe I had a brain injury too.
Right. 17 and adopted five.
We have. Yeah, it's, we love it. And I mean, when we first started, we're like, we'll take one kid, and got a different plan and kept stretching us. And it is absolutely, it's become both of our passions. And we love just being able to help kids in these hard situations know they're loved, they're special. God has an amazing plan. And it takes a lot of work. There's a lot of hard moments, but when you can just stay there and show the kids they're not alone. So many of the struggles I went through helped me to know how to help the kids and to how to be there so that they don't feel alone. And when they're trying to push you away, to push back harder. But it's been absolutely amazing.
I have a 15-year-old son who I'm having a heck of a time with right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the hardest thing I've ever done is raise my son.
Mm-hmm.
And just no matter how hard he pushes back to be there.
Yeah.
That's one. And look at me. I'm 23. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. How do you push through it with 17 and five now adopted?
Yeah.
Emily's like Wonder Woman without the cape. Like, she just, like, the more kids we get, the more energy she has. Like, I don't know how she does it, but I mean, I'll never forget the first time she's like, when we say, like, okay, one child, like, under the age of two, and she's like, Chris, what about two? I'm like, kids. I'm like, no way we can do two kids. That's insane. And then eventually we worked our way up to seven. But you just, like, when you take on more than what you think you can handle, that's when you can realize your potential. And so we just keep finding out that the more we take on, you just figure it out and you just do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say a big thing too is not taking it on your shoulders. What I learned when I went through the depression, like, I learned to depend on God and put everything on him instead of keeping it on myself. Because you have to meet the kids where they are, but then to not let it bring you down, but instead, like, feel enough where you can still get into action and do every single thing you can every single day and let go of what's out of your control. There's so much out of your control. So just knowing and focusing on what we can do and letting the rest go has been very, very helpful to be
so
able to
have
do
you,
it.
So have you guys, I want to phrase this carefully. Have you guys failed in ways that you would have described as a failure 10 years ago and been able to walk away going, we did everything we could and that's a success?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that there's been moments where you feel like we would have previously felt like, you know, we're failing. But you just, when you do absolutely everything you can do and you focus on that and change your perspective to that, it really helps a lot to know. Because obviously some of the kids that we've had in our home have had a lot of behavioral problems and we've seen transformations, but then there's other times that you wish you could do more. You wish that you could change more.
Do you get to a point to where you're like, I don't know. I've done everything I know how. I don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
You get to that, you get to that point, but what's kind of special too, when you stay after it and you stay persistent, like in that moment of like, nothing's working, like we're failing. And then it's like months later, the kid or the child will refer to something that you said months ago that you thought they weren't getting at all. Like nothing that you were saying was registering. And then they apply something that you were trying to teach them months later. And you see little moments like that, that you can see the progress. Mm-hmm. And you just focus on that progress and just chipping away at it, because it's not an overnight thing. Like it's not something that you snap your fingers and all the abuse and trauma that they experience and all the wiring that they've undergone is just gone. It takes a lot of time, a lot of moments.
I will tell you, I'm in my 50s. even though I look 22. And I, you don't need to laugh at that.
No, I just,
and I, or is it 72? And, I still struggle for wisdom, and I'm listening to you two with such deep wisdom that really comes, you can't read wisdom in a book. You can read it in a book, but that's not where it comes mm-hmm. from. It comes from you actually experiencing yeah. it. Do you think you would be anywhere close to who you are or where you are had it not been for your accident and your deep depression?
No, absolutely not. There's no way that I would be able to be a foster parent. We've heard the most unimaginable things with these kids and what they've gone through. And previously with how I was able to cope with that, I mean, honestly, it sent me into the depression and I couldn't handle it. And so now I know exactly how to handle it. I know how to let go of what's out of your control. And don't get me wrong, there are moments that I don't like anybody. Mm-hmm. And it's a battle. You just have to battle it. You have to fight it. And you just have to keep remembering that if you do what you can do as best as you know how and work every day, things do start changing and turning around.
Yeah. And now for me, like, if I could go back and change that play that paralyzed me, I wouldn't do it because I found a life and a purpose worth living for. And I can see and use my pain for a purpose. And it gives me life and inspiration knowing that my struggles can help somebody else through their own pain and struggles.
You two are remarkable. You're truly remarkable. And as a man who has hit lows and has been blessed by a good wife, you're a great woman, and you are greatly blessed. You are greatly blessed, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Vice versa.
She's way out of my league.
Yeah, I think good women usually are out of our league. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, and, thanks for having us.
How can we follow you? How can we follow your adventures?
Well, I know Instagram, Facebook, you know, we have our book coming out, The Seven Longest Yards, mm-hmm. Which shares our struggles and our journey. But, you know, Instagram, Chris A. Norton 16 is a great way to follow me. And that's my handle all across social media. ChrisNorton.org is my website.
Yeah, and then mine for Instagram and Facebook is Emily Summers Norton. And we do, we try to, like, our life purpose is just to help people realize, like, you're not alone. Like, everybody goes through hard things. So many people have looked at me and thought I have everything together. Like, so many comments of, you're perfect. There's nothing going on. And I hit everything. And you have no idea what someone else is going through. Chris, you see his challenges. He's in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Every yep. single one of us struggles. Every single one of us hits those low points. And what it's about is just fighting to get out of it and knowing it's a strength to get help, like you said.
Everyone is in their own wheelchair. Just mm-hmm. most of yes. ours are invisible.
Yeah, yep. absolutely.
You know, and when I found this out when I was an alcoholic, I hid everything. I was mm-hmm. very good mm-hmm. functioning alcoholic. And I said things on the radio that I thought were going to destroy my career because I was done with radio. I'd done it for 20 years and I was done with it. It was back in the 90s. And I said the worst things about me because I was viewed as this, you know, clean cut kind of guy. And I was anything but. Mm-hmm. And I exposed who I was and what I was struggling with. And the opposite happened. I realized the more we're honest with each other, the more we tell, the more we realize I could disagree with you on everything, but we are exactly alike. Mm-hmm. We are exactly alike.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm privileged to people to see my challenges. People are kind and so helpful to me because they see what I'm going through. And
right.
I appreciate that, but we can do that to everyone.
Yeah.
And all the challenges that we're facing would be a better world.
Chris and Emily Norton, the Chris Norton Foundation, ChrisNorton.org, and the book is The Seven Longest Yards. You can pre-order now. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank yep. you for having
God
us.
God bless.
Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, God bless.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Jason Buttrill, who is with us now and our head researcher, I want to talk to you a little bit about Europe and China, but also a little bit about Mueller and what he's going to say here in about 30 minutes on this report. It seems to me, Jason, that this is nothing but a circus and a sideshow. Nobody's really honestly looking for the truth in anything, because the truth is Russia tried to meddle and did meddle with our elections, and they'll do it again. And nobody's talking about that. We're just talking about impeachment, which has no chance of going anywhere. The House can vote for impeachment. Good for them. Then it goes to the Senate. Do you think they're going to pick it up? No. And who's going to suffer at election time? The Republicans and Donald Trump, or the Democrats? The Democrats will pay the price for this.
Yeah, that's from a former member of the intelligence community. That's really the tragedy of this entire thing. Like, we know what Russia did. It's very detailed, the report that they released on how they messed with our election, how they hacked major party organizations, DNC, and everything.
You imagine what the NSA and CIA have on this? That we,
oh my gosh,
for the amount of stuff that we know at our level, and we were talking about 3-4 years ago, before any of this was in the public sphere, we found it on YouTube.
Yeah,
where they're admitting what they were going to do. Imagine what the federal government has, and they're not talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. That's really where the oversight should be right now. It shouldn't be talking about the stupid crap they're talking about now. It should be, wait a minute, like the House Intelligence Committee should be like, so are we identifying what went wrong, and have we hardened ourselves against this in the future? What about all the states? We have an election coming up in a mere matter of months. Why are we not doing something? Hardening. Are we doing something?
What are we doing? When the president said the other day that we had to go to Mars because space was the most important defense thing we could do right now, I disagree. Mm. I think the most important thing we can do is harden our intelligence network and our information network and our election network. We are prime for hacking. And if we are hacked, we end up being in the worst shape, because we are the first world country. When something doesn't work, when we don't have electricity, when we don't have power, when we don't even have air conditioning, we go to hell fast. China doesn't go to hell that fast, because their people are already living a lot like the Stone Age.
Yeah. We are in a new nuclear, like, basically arms race.
Yes,
right now. This is the new, like, before it was actual nuclear weapons. Right now, it's different types of tech. You mentioned China, 5G rollouts. That is crucial right now, and China's destroying us in that. AI right now. There should be a Manhattan Project for artificial intelligence scientists all over the world.
Been saying that for years.
That should be the immigration center right now.
Last week, Samsung released this Mona Lisa project. Did you guys see this? We talked about it last night.
Yeah.
So making the Mona Lisa move and talk, okay? It's a painting. Making it come to life and speak, and they can do it with any picture. That most people didn't realize, that was announced at Samsung AI Moscow.
Wow.
Okay? That's significant. That's deep fake territory. That's deep fake central. And we're not talking about it.
Yeah. Russia actually has a hacking convention every year where they invite all the best hackers and computer scientists into like one central location. I think it's in St. Petersburg. And they give them a task. The tasks are all military. This is frightening. Have you ever heard about this?
No.
They give them a task that's specific to attacking another nation state. So they'll be like, there's a power plant. You have 30 minutes to break into it. What do you do? Or you have 30 minutes to crash it and make it explode.
We're not doing any of that. I at least that I know of. I hope we are. But I don't think we're doing any of that.
Well, we did find out that the NSA did have this tool that's now kind of biting us because it was leaked. But they had a tool that could break into basically every Microsoft computer for several years and never reported it to Microsoft because they liked using it.
Of course.
And once it leaked and now other countries were using it against us, they did go to Microsoft. It's been patched now.
but these whatever computer isn't patched can still be hit by it. Point being, though, they got a lot of tools. I mean, the NSA has a lot of tools.
I know, and I hope we do. I hope we are. I mean, we are in the Sputnik time period now for technology, and whoever gets to the moon first dominates. And I hope to God that it's us. China is not screwing around now. And I think, Jason, I think we have gotten this China thing right from the beginning.
Yep.
We have said it's about 5G. It's about hacking into our businesses and our inventions here. It's about our companies giving away their intellectual property for free to China. It's about unfair practices that China is doing, and China 2025. This is a serious issue.
And this is a transformative economy that we're about to see. We talk about how there's been going to be massive shifts. They're moving away from, you know, creating small, like little stupid little products, you know, that they used to sell off to us, and we still buy via Amazon. That takes about 2 months for them to actually get here to go through customs. But they're moving away from that. But the entire world is really moving away from that. It's going more towards services. Remember, like, Apple now is like, they're like, crud, we're not making as much money on phones anymore. Now they're looking at opening up, like, you know, like Apple TV, doing stuff like that, other services. It's moving in tech services. That's the direction. And China saw this coming from a lot. Why do you think they're trying to expand their 5G network all over the world? Because they want to be the ones dominating that. So do you want the country to dominate the flow of information all over the world? This is what this is really about. The flow of information all over the world. This is the same country that is doing a social credit system amongst their citizens. It's the biggest police state in the world right now. They're jailing their own citizens.
It's the biggest slave state in the world right now.
Right.
It is. It's an abomination. It is. This is the situation that in 100 years from now, our great-grandchildren will all say, you know what? Our great-grandfathers and grandmothers, they were just awful people. They didn't care about the slaves in China. They did nothing about it. We're dealing exactly with the same kind of things that our founders were dealing with, and they looked at business and said, well, it'll work itself out. Let's just go to war when we have to. Let's do these things that we have to do, and it'll work itself out. It will work itself out, and I think with China, it's going to work itself out with war.
Yeah, you can't look at company, like I've heard a lot of people say, look, they're just tech companies in China, and they're competing. You cannot look at tech companies in China versus the same as like tech companies in the rest of the world, especially not here in the United States. Let's take, for instance, Huawei. So Huawei, we delivered a huge blow to Huawei. They're leading the push on 5G right now. The Trump administration just said, look, any U.S. company cannot do business with Huawei, which is a huge deal for Huawei because their phones, which is probably the number two largest phone company in the world now, they all use Google. So now they can't use Google anymore. So they're like, oh, crud, what do we do? They're also making a push to lead in like laptop and computer production. Now they can't use Microsoft. So now they're kind of screwed. Now, the history of Huawei is pretty interesting. And this kind of goes into how these Chinese companies operate. The only reason Huawei is a thing right now is because they stole the source code from U.S. companies that moved into China right after, you know, their introduction into the World Trade Organization. They stole the source code, then copied whatever all the other technology, you know, all the other like how to build certain phones and stuff from U.S. companies. Then they created a clone company of U.S. companies. That person, their CEO, was a former intelligence guy in the People's Republic of China military. His job was to procure technology. That was his entire job. Then he becomes the CEO. He was also a Communist Party member. Now, this is the guy that stole the source code, now has the second largest phone company in the world. If you're a flagship company in China, there is an official Communist Party office located right next to the CEO's office, basically. They're co-located with the company. Huawei is China, Chinese government, the CCP, the
Chinese Communist Party.
That's them. All their flagship companies are the same way. So if you're looking at, well, this is just Huawei trying to like, you know, dominate 5G. No, it's the Chinese Communist Party in China.
It's China 2025, which was a communist goal set out in 2006, somewhere in that area, of where China would be at China 2025. In the year 2025, we are going to dominate the world and the world's information. And Donald Trump is putting a stop to it with this trade war. It's the only thing that makes sense because of the moves we're making. It's the only thing that makes sense because people like Larry Kudlow Stephen Moore, are for this. And when I've talked to Stephen Moore, he has said China's different. And he's right. China is different.
This is you. I flip-flopped, as you know, probably, Stu, on this multiple times, because I just don't know. Like, I am against tariffs as well.
Yeah.
But when you think about China, it's a different animal. Like, I don't know. How else are you going? What other lever are you going
to
pull?
You have to stop them taking all of our stuff.
It's interesting, though. I mean, why is the answer to them stealing our technology a tax on us? Why do we have to pay the penalty for the transfer of technology to them? Because that seems like something they're doing wrong. It's not something that I'm doing wrong. Yet I'm the one who has to pay all the higher prices.
Right, but I don't think you can stop this with the American corporations, because they want that. They'll sell their country out. We know that. Facebook, Google, they'll sell us out in a heartbeat. They don't care. And they're already working with China on really bad things. Mm-hmm. So for the country to say, we have a trade war, and oh, by the way, you cannot do business with this company, this company, this company, that's the next level. This level is, oh, Apple, you want to do that? Okay, go ahead. It's going to cost you 25% more. And so they do pass it on to us. But I think hitting these corporations where they live on the bottom line is the only way you're going to get them to untangle from China.
The Huawei situation seems to be a more direct way of addressing this, though, right? I mean, like, they're going after them because they've committed what we view as, you know, international crimes, basically.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, almost acts of war. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. it's really mm-hmm. serious. But, like, to add, because of those types of things, to add a 20-25% tax that I have to pay on goods from many times companies completely unrelated to them is a very indirect, broad, blunt force thing that punishes American citizens for crimes that China commits.
So here's what I think actually happened. Larry Kudlow, Stephen Moore, and John Bolton, they all know. They all know what China really is. Does Donald Trump know what China really is? I don't know.
He knows they're a serious threat.
He knows they're a serious threat. Is he the architect of this? No. I think what he's the architect of is a trade war. He loves tariffs. Mm-hmm. And so the people in the administration that he surrounded himself with said, okay, you know what? There's some good that we can make happen out of these tariffs. Because nobody's been willing to take them on. He'll take them on under the guise of mm-hmm. tariffs. So let's solve the Huawei stuff. Let's solve some of these things by using tariffs. I think it was their way in, using something that Donald Trump understands how to use and really loves.
Yeah, I think they're making the best of a situation.
I think so too.
They don't prefer.
Right.
Larry Kudlow is very friendly to free trade economics.
Correct.
It's been that way for a long time. But the people he has, like Wilbur Ross and Lighthizer, and I mean, these people are not, they're the exact opposite. I mean, they want to do this whether China is good or bad, which is why you saw, you know, tons of our allies getting hit with these big tariffs as well. This is not just a China situation. It's a broad strategy by the president, but which, by the way, he ran on. I mean, it was a big, you know, big priority of his.
What were
clearly.
Some of the things that we were told off air by people who were very pro-Trump mm-hmm. During the election? I'm glad I want you to know. I got several calls like this from people. I am not for Trump. I just want you to know. I am with you 100% away, but I am not going down the road you're going down, because somebody has to be in his inner circle.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to be able to use the things that he believes in and his bully pulpit and move us in the right direction. And with that, not in a usurping sort of way, exactly what Larry Kudlow said. He talked to the president and was like, no, I'm not. I wouldn't join you because you're for trade war. Then he said something to him for 20 minutes and Larry was like, I'm in. What could that have been? Larry, This is what I want. What do you want? Well, I think China's a danger. Good. Do those things. I want this done. Yeah. I want a better deal with China. You want to hurt China in this way and get that done. I think we can do both. To me, that's what would make somebody like Larry Kudlow go, sure. I'm on board with your trade war.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
So I think that he said some really interesting things. Let me just recap here quickly. WikiLeaks tried to influence, Russia tried to influence. They timed the releases and hacked into things and released it to influence our election. Private businesses in Russia also tried to influence. They did interfere. However, we also looked into obstruction because anybody who was trying to obstruct us looking into were our elections free and fair, we needed to look into. So if there was an accusation, we looked into it. He says part one of his report was about the numerous attempts that did happen by Russia, but there was insufficient evidence to prove a crime when it came to the president or anyone around the president. He said, if we would have known for sure that the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Now, he didn't say if he did commit a crime, we would have said so, because what followed, I thought, was really interesting. He said it would be inappropriate and it would be a process beyond justice if we accused and no court could try. So he said it would be wrong and unjust if we made an accusation that, yeah, we think this guy committed a crime, but no court could try it because he's the president of the United States and it's unconstitutional, he said, to charge a president with a crime, a sitting president. So he said we couldn't charge him with a crime if we found a crime. Now, he didn't say they found a crime, but he also said that they didn't find him innocent of any crime. So you're kind of left in this middle ground. And what he's saying here is there's another judge and jury. And that judge and jury is the American people through the impeachment process, because we can't go through the Justice Department. We did what we were supposed to do. And I have nothing further to say on this. There's nothing that we're hiding. There's nothing that the AG has held back. He endorsed Bob Barr, saying he thought he was fair. I do not question Bob Barr. And he said, my testimony, any testimony from anybody on my team, including me, will not go further than the report that is already public. So you're kind of left with, well, wait, you didn't find anything. But you're kind of saying that if there was something, we wouldn't have said we should. It's a crime because it's unjust to accuse him of a crime. So was there a crime?
Mm. Yeah, because I think what the media is going to take out of that section, which I think was one of the most important sections, is him saying, look, we were prevented from charging him. However, you do have a way to follow up on this.
Yes.
And the media is going to translate that as him basically giving a roadmap to what Congress should do next, which is impeachment. That is how I think people are going to take that in the media and on the left.
But my question is, you impeach him. You just had a grand jury. And so, you know, when a grand jury does an investigation and they do all of this, you issue an indictment. This person committed a crime because of these things. Well, he's just said there's no other information for us to give. We've given you all information. Mm-hmm. Well, we've all read that information with an exception of just a few tidbits that don't seem like they're bombshells, mm-hmm. okay, hidden behind those black bars. They're just names to protect.
A lot of Roger Stone stuff, basically.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he's sending two signals. One, there is a way, if you think the president committed a crime, you have to do it through impeachment. But two, if you're going to interview any of us on the team, we're all going to say the same thing. Everything we have is in that report. Well, there is this weird line in there of if he had committed a crime, we couldn't have said anything. And if we knew he didn't commit a crime, was it? What did he say in the report? If he
was innocent, we would have said so.
We would have said so. Right.
Basically, if we could have proved his innocence, we would have said so.
But like you said, on the other hand, if he would have been guilty, we wouldn't have said so.
Right. Right.
So it kind of helps nobody.
It helps nobody
and it certainly doesn't help Trump.
Because if we have all of the information, well, then where's the crime?
Right.
What is the crime?
Right. What they're saying is there's a way to take this, right? And I think the left will take it this way. Certainly the Ocasio-Cortezes of the world will take it this way, which is saying he can't say that there's a crime that has been committed. However, he believes there is a crime that has been committed and you should go and impeach him for it because that's the only way he can be punished for that crime.
Yeah, but what is the crime?
Well, he's saying it's all there. This is a crime.
Where? Again, did you see it? You read the report.
And to be clear, I'm not saying this, but I'm saying that the left will be making this argument, which is there are a lot of examples of things that we could say were obstruction of justice. You know, him asking for Mueller to be fired
You can look at it that way.
But in reality, there's
no smoking gun. This is something that if this is all the information, which he just said, we have no other information. It's all out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's all out there.
Yep.
Okay, well, it's all out there. Well, I don't see anything that is a smoking gun. You could look at certain things and go, yeah, that was not good. And that probably was maybe that skirts. But there's no smoking gun on anything. And so what you're doing now is saying we couldn't prosecute and bring to a court of law. But I honestly don't see, even if you could, we've all now seen all of the information.
Right.
And I wouldn't, if I'm an attorney general, I'm not bringing that to a courtroom.
No.
Even if constitutionally I could, I don't think you have a strong enough case. Beyond a reasonable doubt, no way.
Democrats won't mind that, though.
No.
They'll do it anyway. Because of their sheer hatred for him.
But I think they will pay a heavier price for it.
It's possible. I mean,
maybe.
I think there's a good argument to be made, though, on the other side, is what Mueller is basically saying with his press conference is, look, I did my job. I got nothing else for you. Leave me alone.
Yeah, he is
saying
that.
You see what's sitting there. If you think it's enough, go for impeachment. But stop bugging me.
Yeah,
I think that's exactly a fair reading of where he is.
And that's probably why he did this press conference today.
Right.
I will say the Barr thing was like maybe the biggest moment in there because Mueller saying that he believes Barr was acting in good faith with what he did with the letter is a huge part of the story. Because the main point of evidence that the Democrats had against Barr was to say that Mueller wrote this letter. And he said, I want you to release more, and you're not doing this. And they tried to make it out like Mueller was really pissed off. As you see in that press conference, Mueller is telling you he's not pissed off about
quote,
it.
Quote, right. I do not question Bob Barr.
That's big.
That's huge.
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 The problem is, after 2 years, we want something definitive.
Yeah.
Give us definitive, and we just don't have it.
And we have definitive on
the collusion.
On collusion.
Yes.
And we have.
And that would have been the crime.
Right. And we have definitive on Russia and WikiLeaks.
Yeah. Yep.
We have all this evidence. There's no evidence. There's just this, like, well, maybe, I don't know. I guess you could read it that way. But you don't put people in jail for that. And you don't take away the presidency for that. There's no smoking gun, as he said. Everything that we had to say and we found is out.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.